Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens. Victoria Sampson is one seriously impressive lady.
She is. I say, I'm a visionary. We used it, but it's fascinating now that sort of out of adversity, another almost out of adversity, comes where she is now with that report that she did. I just think it's fascinating, especially when she is so young. I can say that because I am old, but what she's already got her teeth into, what she's already doing is her age.
I love the way it came about, you know, when people hear the story about her DJing and how that came about. That's quite cute. But what she did during COVID, when most people were making banana bread, to use her phrase, has put her on a clinical and a business path that actually wasn't there before.
No.
It wasn't even really a known path to walk down.
No.
It was just open land, and she's created this path. And I think for people in dentistry, seeing the things she's doing and understanding it, and I think when you do something very new and very different, it's easy for people to kind of scoff at it or be skeptical.
But
there's no doubt.
Cranky.
I think the way that it's been engaged with from the medical profession is something that I guess she hopes is going to filter through to dentistry. But a really, really interesting conversation today.
I thought it was brilliant. Very good. Very nice.
Absolutely. So, Squire, here we are again. We
have another one. And a beautiful day. Those people who can't see in our studio, we are looking out on beautiful blue skies. But another fabulous podcast.
Absolutely. We're so looking forward to it. So, ladies and gentlemen, today we are joined by Victoria Sampson. Victoria's a dentist, co-principal of the Health Society in Mayfair.
Ooh,
very nice part of the world.
That's very nice.
Oral microbiome specialist and DJ. So
we've got
a lot of stuff to get through. Welcome, Victoria. how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me today.
Pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we are as well. There's a lot going on in your world, and given that you've fairly recently opened your practice, it'll be nice to find out how that's going and all the turl and turmoil that went into getting that practice set up.
Trepidation and excitement.
It's been a couple of months since we opened, so it's completely opened my eyes and changed my life, really. It's interesting.
Yeah, we last met at the Global Dental Collective, the event that Mehi and Joe put together, which was a great night. And you were on the decks, you were DJing later on in the evening after being one of the guests talking about your dental experience on the night and sharing with the audience. But you were then on the decks, and you've said that if it wasn't dentistry, you would have been a DJ. Is that serious? Is that a real passion and a love for you?
Yeah, it really is. I think. If my life turned out a bit different, that would definitely be something I would want to do. And even now, even though I am a dentist and all of this, I'm always like, I could still elope and live in Ibiza and be a DJ.
Have you done any club DJing? Was it gin? Because gin was Ministry of Sound, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done ministry, but I've done a few clubs. But I'm fairly early on, like, with DJing. I only learned a couple of years ago. I've always been... Right. Very musically kind of minded. Whenever I was going to a party or, you know, someone was having an event, they would always be like, oh, Victoria, can you make the playlist? Oh, Victoria, can you take over and play the music? And this is since I was, 16, 17. I was every single party, it was me playing the music. And then a couple of years ago, one of my really good friends was getting married. And she was like, my wedding gift from you is for you to DJ at my wedding. And I was like, I've never DJed in my life. I don't know how to do it. And she was like, you're made for DJing. Like, you have to do it. So I learned to DJ for her wedding. And my first ever event was a wedding in front of about 400 people where I DJed.
Oh, cool.
And that kind of changed everything. And I started to actually DJ and here we are now.
if she hadn't... forced your hand, for want of a better phrase of words, in saying this is your gift to me, which kind of puts the pressure on you that you kind of got to do it. Do you think you'd have ever got to a stage where you would have done it, or would you've always been somebody who in your kitchen or your bedroom would have been the person just DJing to yourself?
I think I probably would have stayed in my bedroom playing the music, because it does take
good for you. Good for your friend then. She really brought something out of you.
At the end, I was like, thank you for pushing me to do this, because I love it. And I'm actually not that bad at it either, because I love music so much. And you know,
it's a skill.
It's actually really difficult.
You know, you can go to, not that I've been to clubs, but you can go places, can't you, where they sort of, the music just totally misses it. And then, you know, people were there and then they're off. So I think it is a skill. It's sort of an underrated skill, really.
Massively. Like if I go to a club and the music's bad or the DJ is terrible, I'm out. Like I can't do it.
It's almost like an earworm just in there and annoys you.
So dentistry was lucky because you nearly had a fork in the road and you decided to go down the dental route and not the DJ route. And your sister, who you're in business with now.
Can I just ask a quick question? Did you have like a DJ name all lined up?
I still don't really have a DJ name. Lots of people have made names for me. And people are trying to make like a dental name. So, you know, I've had, you know, but I think Dr. Victoria was the one that kind of worked the best, apparently. And I don't like it. So I don't really have a name because I don't know yet.
It'll come.
Saliva Samson.
Over time.
Probably doesn't quite work, does it? No, that's not really a good DJ name, is it? Sal Samson. There you go. How about that? Anyway, I interrupted. I was just intrigued.
So dentistry, was that because obviously your sister is, she's slightly older than you, isn't she, your sister? Yeah. So did she kind of turn your head towards dentistry? Was it something that you were always destined to be a dentist? Is there family connections?
She would definitely like to say that she influenced me. We don't actually have.
I heard the words
family.
Like to say.
Yeah, she would. A bit of sibling rivalry again on there.
We don't actually have any other family who are dentists. We have greater family, but you know, my mom and dad were both in finance. Everyone else has kind of been maybe doctors or lawyers or finance or that type of thing, and then. My sister became a dentist, and when I was choosing what to study, I actually wanted to go into law. And then I was like, actually, I'm, you know, my A-levels and GCSEs, I was really good at science. And so I was like, okay, let me do something scientific. But I'm also really good with people. And I was like, I don't really want to be in a lab behind a microscope and not interacting. And medicine, I wasn't too keen on just because of, I think, the lifestyle that doctors have. You have to be extremely passionate about medicine for it to be your job. So I was like, not really sure. And I saw her going through and I was like, looks kind of cool. Like you get to, you know, meet people, you are very creative. There's a lot of artistry involved. And, you know, it's also, there's an element of business to it if you want it to be a business. And so for me, I was like, okay, it kind of combines everything I like. And here I am now.
What age were you, Victoria, when you were going through this sort of thought process? Was this kind of when you were choosing to do? Did you do your education in England?
I say because your accent is an interesting one. So,
I did. I only lived in America for about 2 years when I was about 8 years old.
Okay. Wow, you've retained quite a strong element of their accent.
I've now got this weird amalgamation of American English.
Go with charming over weird. I think charming is better than
intriguing.
Weird. So you were around kind of A-level age where you were having to go through this thought process and piece it together.
Yeah, exactly. So I literally only decided when I was 18. It wasn't one of my passions when I was a child growing up to be a dentist or anything like that. It was kind of like, it will work and worst comes to worst and I don't like dentistry, then I can go into business or I can go into law. And my mother was a really big kind of impact in my decision making. And she was like, you know, if you... you know, you can study dentistry and still do lots of other things afterwards, but you can't study business or, you know, English or anything like that and then become a dentist. And so I was like, okay, let's see how this works.
It's just, I find it intriguing that people, you know, in your case, you were kind of 17, 18 and going through this thought process. And it seems to be a common theme with lots of dentists. They're very clear about what they want to do from quite a young age. And I think lots of people don't kind of work it out. And we have some people who qualify in dentistry slightly older, but the majority tend to kind of do traditional schooling, A-levels, and then go on to university. There might be a year or two in between, but that's pretty much the path. And I just find it intriguing that dentists seem to be very clear from a young age the direction that they want to go in. And you talking about, you know, the artistry, the communication skills. Yeah. I was good at science. You really piece together all those critical elements that makes a good dentist so young.
I say, there's always a bit of creativity that there seems to be in the dentist that we speak to, that whatever it might be, music, models, whatever, there's always that sort of creative bit. It's quite interesting.
With the DJ side, isn't it?
Yeah,
clearly that's a real strong part of your skill set.
It's a transferable skill.
Yeah. So you were saying you spent a couple of years in the States. What was your upbringing like? How did your parents kind of, you know, mould you and your sister to be the people you are today?
I think my parents they're pretty, they made us work hard, you know, like I'm from a Middle Eastern background. My mother's Iranian. You know, it wasn't enough to just get like a B in your exams. You know, she wanted a star, and it was always like that. And, you know, maybe I complained when I was younger, but then, you know, at the end of the day, it meant that I did do pretty well in my exams, and she definitely made me a very hardworking person. So I think, I also was a bit of I had a lot, way too much energy as a child. Like I think my parents didn't know what to do with me half the time. So they just put me in like 1,000 different classes and courses. And, you know, I couldn't sit still for an hour. So I was just always running around. I was in every sports team. I was, you know what I mean? I was like that annoying kid who didn't really have much of a social life because she was just like playing tennis or going to some sort of language class or this and that. And it was because I actually wanted to do it. My mom kind of, she was like, let's make you do everything. And then you can decide what you like and drop down a few classes and just focus on those. And I was like, no, I want to do ballet and football. I want to do you know, I want to paint and I want to play tennis. And so, I think I was very lucky that I was able to do all of those things and kind of learn a lot from a young age.
It's interesting because there's also then a combination. Yet again, a lot of dentists, well, the successful guys we speak to, there's that sport thing, isn't there? And it's interesting the fact of your sports, by the sounds of things, were individual but also team. So you've sort of got your own resilience of being an individual, but also you need to know how to fit into a team, which is a dental practice.
I agree with you. I think that sports, from everyone I know who is successful, even not in dentistry, kind of physical activity and sports is a very kind of strong thing that all of them have. And I think part of it's to do with the mental resilience and being able to actually push through. And for me, even now, I'm not doing ballet and tennis classes and all these things, but if I'm stressed out, my number one go-to is exercising and going for a run. So now I run all the time. I do boxing, all of these types of things. And it's not from a physical perspective. I'm not sitting here thinking, oh, I want to lose weight or I want a six pack or anything like that. It's genuinely just because if I exercise, I have better clarity of mind. I relax, I de-stress. And I think that once you start to see exercise as kind of a tool for your mental health, things completely change.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think exercise is wonderful. And depending on what you're doing, it requires your self-focus. I remember years ago, somebody said to me, skip. If you try skipping, you can think of nothing else other than just making sure you're skipping. But as I said, from a clear in your mind, it's fabulous because you do. You have to concentrate so hard to skip well. There isn't space for other thoughts to creep in. So they say it's almost like a form of meditation because it excludes all other thoughts.
Because if you get it wrong, you're over.
Yeah, exactly, while you're doing it. We've kind of we've sort of teased around like art and artistry for a while, and clearly artistry is becoming a bigger part of dentistry than it ever has been with aesthetics and the cosmetic side of things. So would you say that having that in your kind of, you know, your kit bag of some sort and having an interest in art aids you as a dentist? Does it mean that you kind of have a better understanding of what those aesthetic outcomes could be?
I definitely think so. I think that, you know, there's so many different dentists out there, and you have some who are purely cosmetic or aesthetic dentists and they're only doing, you know, smile makeovers, and maybe they're a little bit more aesthetically trained than others. But I think every dentist has to have some sort of, I think every dentist has a bit of ADHD, or not ADHD, but more of like an obsessive They're OCD. Perfectionists. OCD, wrong acronym. They're obsessive and perfectionists about something. Mm. And also they do have to have some element of creativity. And it doesn't have to mean that they are amazing at painting a picture, but it's about, you know, even doing the most standard filling on a on a molar that no one's ever going to see, but understanding kind of the anatomy of the teeth, of you know, how it, you know, all of those types of things. And I think good dentists definitely are slightly creative as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's like Shiraz, isn't it? What's that course that he does? That,
oh, Sculpt. His composite course.
Yeah, I always think that's fascinating. And the fact of, you know, as a non-clinician, you just think, well, that's a sort of like composite, isn't it, really? Mm. But he teaches people how to put their own, not by personality as such, but, you know, how to make it. And that's the artistry part, isn't it? Which is fascinating, because I saw something else online. I think I was at Manrina, and she said something about 13,000 veneers, but she was sort of saying that each is individual, you know, and if they're not individual, we as humans can go, that doesn't look quite right, because it's almost too perfect.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Recreating human form. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
It is, and everything about our smiles are specific to us. And, you know, so, you know, some people have more rectangular teeth, and that's meant to be a little bit more masculine. Curved edges are meant to be a bit more feminine. Like, all of these things, I think people sometimes forget about, but they're so important, and you cannot just copy and paste the same smile for every single person. And even myself, clinically, I have definitely a way of doing things, and my fillings, when I see my fillings in someone's mouth, I know they're mine because of the way that I've done them. And I'm like, ah, that's me.
Oh, really?
The other one, that's not me. Yeah. I can even, you know, you sometimes see another dentist's work and you're like, wow, this dentist is fantastic. Or the other one's like, oh, not so great. But a lot of it's to do with aesthetics again.
And do you, as your skill has developed, and I don't know, I'm assuming there's patients that you've seen, do you sometimes look back on the sort of, like, you know, version one of Victoria filling and think, ooh, nowadays I wouldn't have been very happy with that, because you've evolved as your skill and technique?
Yeah, definitely, 100%. And I think that one of the problems with social media is that people compare themselves to, you know, some of the best dentists out there, and they're like, oh, why is my, you know, composite bonding not exactly like XYZ? Or, you know, and we're always evolving, we're always improving and changing. And I think another kind of key characteristic of a good dentist is someone who is open to change and to evolving. So, you know, I'm constantly doing courses, I'm constantly trying out new products and seeing which one works best with my patient, kind of doing my own little clinical trials on my patients to see what works best and what doesn't, because you know, what you learn at university, you know, is not always, it's not going to be exactly the same 10 years later.
I was going to ask you, sorry, I'm fascinated. You know, you mentioned that thing about masculine teeth are a bit squarer or something, and feminine. Is that taught at dental school, or is that something you learn post-dental school because it's not a functional thing?
So I learned it post. I think that dental school, I mean, trained me fantastically, you know, love my university, but it trained me to be a good bread and butter dentist and to be able to drill and fill and do some crowns. But it definitely did not train me aesthetically to do composite bonding, to do smile designing, any of those types of things. And those are courses that I went on afterwards to learn those things.
Which school did you go to?
I went to Barts in London.
Excellent. And what was your dental school experience like? Was it good?
I mean, yes and no. maybe I shouldn't have named my university. No.
We might need to unpack. Unpack the...
I loved my university. I loved my professors and my teachers, and it's a very small university, so it's a very small class. There were about 60 to 100 people in my year. Nice. And the advantage of that is that it becomes a really tight-knit family and you know everyone very well. But I think the disadvantage is that sometimes if you, you know, it's such a small group that, you know, if you don't find exactly your friends from day one, it's difficult to maybe find them later on. And it's not like some universities like King's, for example, I think it's 300-350 people per year. So, you know, okay, you don't make friends first day round. You're like, I'll try again next week. I'll try again the week after. And I loved everyone in my class, but, you know, we're all a little bit different. And I had a good and bad relationship with my university. I wasn't very passionate about dentistry. I went through a few phases of wanting to leave. I was in my third year, I was very close to leaving. And I actually went and did work experience at a law firm during my summer, because I was like, I'm out, I'm gonna, you know, finish early, and then just go and do a law conversion. And thankfully I didn't.
What dragged you back?
My Erasmus, actually. So I got into an Erasmus in Stockholm. So I went to Karolinska Institute for a couple of months. And that's where my idea of dentistry completely changed. And before that, you know, I was like, okay, fine, drill and fill. Like, okay, this is pretty boring. Like, it is what it is. And then I went to Karolinska, and they are very renowned in the world, and it's the best dental school in the world. And they're doing crazy research on, you know, diabetes and gum disease. They were doing cardiovascular disease and gum disease. And they were the ones who really opened my eyes to the fact that the mouth is connected to the rest of the body, and that we can actually, you know, when we're doing a lot of our treatments, we're actually helping a person's general health as well.
Yeah.
And that's where, I guess, my journey into where I am now really started.
Wow.
It's interesting, because you obviously then, almost like an epiphany, went from, and this is going to sound rude to anyone listening, but it's not meant to be, from being a dentist to appreciating that you were a healthcare profession for the whole of the body. And that was the changing moment for you. Fascinating, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also realizing that, you know, every dentist has a different set of kind of skills, and not every dentist can be exactly the same. Like, I always think, like, endodontists, it takes a special type of person to be doing root canals all day, a special type of person to do, you know, gum treatment all day. So, and every personality has a different, maybe, specialty that works for them. And, you know, for me, I realized that I'm not going to be very good at just doing fillings all day. I would get bored. And some people love that and they're great at it. But for me, I was like, I want to do something where I'm, you know, working with kind of with other people, collaborating, understanding the connection between the mouth and the rest of the body, and doing research. And so, you know, I think you can really make dentistry whatever you want it to be. Mm. And I think that there's a really bad kind of assumption that when you're a dentist, everyone's the same and we're all doing the same thing, because we're not.
Mm. So based on what you described, you graduated in 2018, you then did your FD year, but you then quickly opted out from the NHS and went private. And was that kind of driven by your desire to be doing this sort of work that wouldn't have been available to you if you were treating patients on the NHS? Was that kind of, I'm only interested because obviously, you know, there's at the moment there's quite a lot of chat about people leaving the NHS, not wanting to work on the NHS. But it sounds like your reason for it was driven by your desire to do slightly different clinical work.
I think that was one of the driving factors for sure. And then I also found myself after my FD, I was very lucky to be hired part-time at a private dental practice. And it was, you know, it opened my eyes to a whole other way of doing dentistry. And then I was working half NHS, half privately. And the way that we were doing treatments and the way we were looking at patients, you know, was very different. And I found it really difficult to work NHS one day and then fully private the next day. And in terms of time, in terms of the quality of the work, everything, and both of them have, big stresses, and you know, they're one is not easier than the other at all. But it's more about, in my head, I wasn't able to just flip flop and say, okay, cool, I'm going to do a filling in 10 minutes on one day and then a filling under rubber dam and all of this for an hour the next day. I couldn't. And so what was happening was I was starting to feel that I was bringing my kind of NHS way of doing things to the private world and my private expectations to the NHS world. And I just couldn't do it. So I had to choose one. And for those who can do it, amazing, go you, but I couldn't. And it was impacting my mental health because I was not sleeping at night because I was like, my feelings aren't good enough or I'm not doing this well.
Oh, really? What was creating personal stress for you?
Massively, because I wasn't good enough for the private world, but I was also a bit too much of a diva, maybe for my NHS practice. I'll be like, I need this burr. Where's my polishing stuff? I want to do this. And it was really difficult
But this is all quite early on in your career as well, isn't it?
The core of this is caring, isn't it? The fact of your caring about what you're delivering.
Wanting to do the best job possible. How did you work through that? Was there help for you? Were you able to talk to people about it?
Screamed a lot and played music.
I did. So COVID also happened at the same time. So this was in 2020? And my mentor at my private practice was kind of pushing me to go on courses and to improve my quality of work and all of that. And then my NHS principal was telling me I wasn't working fast enough and I needed to see 10 more patients extra a day. So 40 patients a day. And I was like, and then COVID happened and everything stopped. And I was able to just sit there and think a little bit and kind of understand my finances. And that's where I made the jump because of really COVID. Mm. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. So in a really weird way, it came at a great time for you because you could have either imploded or gone one way or the other.
And or become a lawyer.
Yeah, or not necessarily be the path that you want. I'm interested, you're obviously well known and hugely into the oral microbiome and we'll come on to sort of salivary diagnostics, which is a phrase that you found out about 3 days ago.
It's not which is fascinating.
Really. But did that trigger in your mind start to make you think that this might be an area of interest when you went to Stockholm? Was it triggered there or was it in a different time?
Different time, actually. So when I was in Stockholm, it just made me realize that the mouth was, not a separate entity and that, there was a lot of research going on and, there was a very different side of dentistry, but that was kind of it at that time. And then actually, once again, COVID came to help me out. When I wasn't working, those 3-4 months where we weren't working, I just got really bored because I didn't, as I told you earlier, you can't leave me alone for an hour without me like doing something. And I decided to write a paper. And my paper was basically hypothesizing that having poor oral health would predispose you to worse COVID complications. And so I wrote a very big long paper on it whilst everyone else was making like banana bread. And I was like, and I was like, this is huge. And my thing was kind of, I thought we, as dentists, we didn't know how COVID was going to impact us and whether or not, certain things were going to change. And so I wanted to write a paper on that, and all the risk factors that were associated with COVID, with worse COVID complications, were also similar risk factors to periodontal disease. I wrote that paper, got published by the BDJ, and it was the first in the world to
about 24 or something. You must have been quite young then, wasn't it? You're young now, but I mean that's like a bit of a ballsy move, isn't it? Really? Yeah. So hey, look, I haven't done this much, but I'm going to write a paper.
It's the old adage: if you're good enough, you're old enough.
Yeah, that's true,
isn't it? I love the fact that we have a system that enables somebody at your age to write a paper, gets published in the BDJ, gets the deserved plaudits it should. You haven't got to be a 50-year-old professor before you're allowed to join in that conversation.
True, join that crew. Yeah.
It's very true. Yeah. There was definitely a really good opportunity for me there. And the BDJ even, they were a bit like, should we publish this? Because this is the first paper of its kind in the world. And are we right to be doing this? And they took a risk on me and they published it and it blew up. It did really, really well because everyone was like, it kind of gave dentists, I think, a little bit more justification for the treatments that they were doing on their patients. And it told patients that their gum health was very important. And if they wanted to actually reduce their risk of COVID complications, they need to think about their mouth as well. And that's where microbiome testing started for me. So after that, I got approached by a couple of universities, and they wanted to do research on my hypothesis. And the only way that we could actually look at COVID patients in ICU was through their saliva, because we weren't able to go into the ICU to look in their mouths and do a checkup. So we collected their saliva and we did tests, you know, microbiome testing. We did a lot of different things to see whether or not their microbiome was imbalanced and if that was what was increasing their risk of COVID complications. And fast forward 6 months or so, I then was like, wait, why aren't we doing microbiome testing on our own patients? Why are we, you know,
only doing why the is people this in only... ICU, yeah.
Exactly. I was like, this is awesome, because for once we're able to quantify disease, and a lot of dentistry is very qualitative. And we sit there and we kind of just say lots of names and words, but we don't often have numbers that we can give patients and say, you have, you know, 25% of this or a seven, you know, we don't do that very much.
Is this, you know, you have this phrase about putting the mouth back in the body. We were fortunate to meet with Miguel Stanley earlier on this year. And we talked to him about, he was talking to us about inflammation and this kind of whole, you know, body philosophy. It's very similar to the things that you're talking. Is this, you know, the oral microbiome and the diagnostics that you're talking about, can you see a day when this is going to be mainstream in dentistry, or is this always going to be a specialist area within dentistry?
I think there will be a bit of entry level kind of mainstream testing. And then it will be kind of similar to the rest of the specialties, where general dentists can do a lot of the maybe more simple side of things. And then when things get a bit more complicated, they refer on. I think that quantitative dentistry or salivary diagnostics and being able to look in the saliva for inflammatory markers, for bacteria, for all of these things.
What can you identify? What can you sort of identify? What diseases? Could you have diabetes or something like that? Is that something you can? Because I'm just thinking from an NHS point of view, if they could identify that before, I mean, that would be a great one. I mean, we know the NHS, we won't even go about that, but it's a great preventative tool, couldn't it be? You know, amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think 100%, because, you know, one of the problems with healthcare in the UK, in my opinion, is that we often treat diseases before, you know, when it's way too late. And this is medical and dental. And part of the reason for that is that we're not a preventative society. People don't go to the doctor for a checkup. You know, they go when they're in pain and when they have problems. And whereas dentistry, we're lucky, kind of, that patients do come in regularly for checkups. Mm. And they should, they know that they should come in regularly. Yeah. And so if we can actually relieve the load from the medical side of things by doing screening in the dental chair, then we could actually make, you know, we could reduce the cost of a lot of things on the NHS. So if we could screen for diabetes, vitamin D, you know, a lot of these, even osteoporosis, there's some companies that are coming out with, with screening of dental x-rays, which is then able to tell you your risk of osteoporosis elsewhere in your body. And those types of things, if you could screen patients and say to them that they have early osteoporosis before they fracture their hip, then you're saving, you know, £500,000 on that patient for the NHS.
Do you know, it's only just hit me that actually I'm 60 years old, and actually it's the first time I've really thought, you're right, we go and see the dentist every 6 months. But we don't go. We don't have a health checkup unless someone says, "Why don't you go and have a health checkup?" Oh, you're in pain. It is sort of really counterintuitive, isn't it? You should sort of be going. It's almost like you only go to the doctors because you think there's something wrong, whereas you don't only go to the dentist
to stay well.
I never really thought about it.
But also, I wonder whether the things you're talking about may well start to be driven by patient demand as well. So I'm thinking of Tim Spector with his Zoe platform about food and diet and nutrition. You know, there's a craving among the population to understand more about what we eat and how it affects us and where we get our energy from and how we can perform better. And I wonder whether the things you're talking about, if as people, as population, we start to understand the importance of our oral microbiome, and we understand there's diagnostics that help us understand more about our health and how our mouth affects us completely. If patients start requesting it, that may be a way that it starts to filter out into dentistry at a more rapid rate.
Yeah. So the kind of work that I've been doing over the past few years, is mainly patient driven. It's definitely not driven by the dental industry, because, you know, some people are starting to get where I'm coming from now and they're like, okay, or, you know, they want to start doing microbiome testing, you know, dentist wise. But, you know, for a long time, I was the first and the only person out there doing it. People thought I was weird or
a bit cranky,
stupid,
I'd imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit just like, what is she doing? You know, it's been working all this time. Like gums, you know, periodontal specialists, they've always been like, well, it works for me, so why do I have to change it? I'm like, well, it's not really working.
But we're always crazy, you know, until everybody else starts doing it, aren't we?
Exactly. And so what was happening was that, you know, I was doing all of this stuff and then patients were the ones who were finding me, and then their friends would find me. And all of a sudden I went from being, you know, not that busy dentist to being fully booked and like weeks in advance, and people traveling from around the world to have their microbiome checked by me and to check their saliva. And that's what then drove me to open my clinic, was because it was just getting so busy and I could see that there was such a demand from patients that it would have been silly not to do this.
Mm. So what is, you mentioned you've literally just opened your clinic as well with your sister, haven't you? The Health Society in Mayfair. So what's the mix of services that you offer to patients? Is there's a core general dentist element and then some of these diagnostic services alongside?
Yeah. So we do, you know, we do all the traditional dental stuff as well. But then we have add-ons. So we do oral microbiome testing. We have something called the full MOT. And so this is the most kind of in-depth oral check on the market. And what we do is we check your vitamin D levels, your blood glucose levels. We do an oral microbiome test. And then we also check your saliva for certain enzymes and the pH of your saliva too. Mm. And that gives us a full insight into not only your oral health, but also can give us a connection with the rest of your health and maybe flag up things that need to be looked at in more detail.
Wow. On your new patients, how many, in some percentage terms, if you know, how many would be people who just sort of came because they saw a dentist or your SEO was dentist, and how many come because of the microbiome stuff? Is it mainly those people and then they become patients, or is it sort of like half and half, or do you know what I mean? Is there some people who just go, I'm just coming to the dentist. Oh, I didn't know you did that, rather than other people who've searched for you on that bit and said, right, I'm going to do the diagnostic and then I'll be a patient.
I think probably 5 to 10% are people who are just walking on the street and they just want a dentist and they don't even know what we do. And the other 95 or 90% are people who call in and they say, I want an oral microbiome test. I want to see Victoria, or I want guided biofilm therapy. And so again, this is where it's so patient driven. Wow. And I think that our generation, this new generation of patients, are a lot more educated than maybe previously, and they are searching. They know what they want. They will travel far for what they want as well.
Mm. Wow. Any dentist listening, flip.
Yeah.
That's a USP, isn't it?
And you get a fair degree of referrals from doctors as well, don't you? They send their patients to you as well. So it sounds like perhaps the doctor and the medical profession is on board with this more quickly than the dental profession. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. So I get most of my referrals from nutritionists, doctors, functional practitioners, and they're often not the easiest cases. It's often not a healthy patient who's just interested in their mouth. It's more patients who are suffering from maybe other chronic inflammatory diseases, or you know, they're going through a lot of treatment like chemotherapy or whatnot, and they need a lot more support during that. The majority, you're right. I think the medical side of the profession has kind of been like, oh, wait, this kind of makes sense. And I think that with the diagnostics that we do, it's stuff that doctors can understand, whereas previously, you know, if we were doing, you know, pocket charting or We're just doing our own dental. We've got a little dental bubble and we use our own terminologies and it's all very qualitative. And, you know, no one outside of the dental world really understands what we're doing. And I think that's where the lack of trust from patients comes from. Right. And also the lack of appreciation from the medical world, because they just don't get it. They're like, okay, whatever. Like they're like doing a scale and polish. Like what, it's not that important. But then when you start saying, actually, this patient has high levels of bad bacteria in their mouth, their saliva is very acidic, you know, they have high levels of inflammatory markers, then everyone is like, oh, that makes sense. Okay, that's not good. How do I change that?
It's visionary in a way, isn't it? You know, so,
oh, it's groundbreaking.
You know, it's
stuff.
Unbelievable. Yeah. You have that your title at the top, you know, DJ visionary.
Visionary.
I think for me, what's I guess challenging as well is setting up a squat dental practice is not an easy thing to do, which is why most people buy an established dental practice, because they just take somebody else's hard work and they build on that, but they don't have to start with a blank piece of paper. You and your sister didn't just have a blank piece of paper. You didn't even have a piece of paper, because you've created a practice that kind of didn't exist before.
Yeah.
How challenging was that to establish a squat dental practice with a suite of services that you kind of couldn't really Google because it's such a new area?
But I did have a paper of beating a BDJ.
Yes.
I could wave. Yeah.
How was that?
It's probably been one of the most difficult years of my life, but also one of the most rewarding. I think you're right, because we didn't have even the CQC, for example, when they came to give the to inspect us. Some of our services they'd never heard of before, and they didn't even, we have an infrared sauna in our clinic. So we have a full infrared sauna downstairs. We have a personal training suite, you know, all of this. And the CQC was like, what the hell? Like, we don't understand this. And so, you know, and imagine them, they are our regulatory body and they don't understand what we're doing.
I was going to say, did you have to approach a bank for finance?
No, we actually didn't.
Okay.
We
I just imagined the bank manager trying to work that one out.
We wanted to, but it was difficult because they didn't understand what we
were
doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would have thought they wouldn't know what you were on about.
No, and we had no business knowledge beforehand. We don't have any other businesses. So basically, all of our savings have been put into this. Mm. So this is everything that we've worked for. It's just been put into this clinic. And we've had a lot of help from a lot of the dental companies that we work for. You know, I'm an ambassador and key opinion leader for a couple of companies, and they've been awesome. And like, here, you know, we'll give you this for free for 6 months and pay us back later. You know, things like which really helped us.
But also not just financial help. It really validates the work you're doing
and definitely. The
direction you're going in. If people aren't supporting you, you're like, okay, are we doing the right thing here? Whereas I think sometimes support that's non-financial is as important as financial. And I get you need an amount of money to set a practice up. But if people are backing you and rooting for you, on those days when you wake up and it's raining and wet and cold and you have to drag your backside out of bed and you don't really want to, it gives you that sense of purpose that there's other people like fighting for you.
Yeah, I think that also really gave us that validation that we needed, because as you said, I mean, for 7 or 8 months, I was working full-time in two dental practices from 9 to 7 or 8 to 6 every day, and then going to a construction site before work, during my lunch and after work every day, including Saturdays and Sundays. So I was dead. And the only thing that was giving me a little bit of motivation was patients who kept on emailing and asking when the next slot was available. And these companies, which were so supportive that they were willing to invest or to not be paid for months because they believed in our vision. And they were like, actually, you know what, like this girl is not, you know, she knows what she's doing, or she, you know, has a good idea. Let's support that.
It's big trust in a young person. I don't mean that rudely, but do you know what I mean? You are young, isn't it? You know, it's probably hundreds of thousands of pounds invested in someone that think, she's obviously got something about you that carries people.
I think what's fascinating as well is there's two things that have stood out. Your friend insisted as your wedding present that you would DJ for her, which sparked your interest in being a DJ, and you've carried that through your life. And as a result of COVID, you decided to write your oral microbiome paper to say, actually, there's issues here and people with COVID may suffer, you know, greater problems. And it's funny how you really take those situations and turn them to your advantage. Because like you say, lots of people could have said no to the DJ set and they'd still be in their bedroom. And you might have been amazing at making banana bread. But instead, you submitted a paper to the BDJ. But the thing is that kind of sparked this interest in the area that has now led you to have your own practice.
It's amazing.
So it's amazing that, you know, you didn't have to do those things, but as a result of doing them, your path is now significantly different to many other dentists.
I'm just thinking, what are you going to do for the next 30 years?
Big expectations. No,
I hope we haven't peaked too early, Victoria, for goodness sake.
Honestly, maybe I will. I'm going to pack up and go in a couple of years.
You're going to get to 30 and say, no, I've had enough.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it. Yes. Yeah.
I know it's still fairly early days in the practice. It's not long since been open. But what are the myths of owning a dental practice? What are the things that people assume it is? And what's the brutal reality?
And can we throw in highs and lows in there?
Yeah, highs
and lows.
Squat practice or just general opening your own clinic?
Both or either.
So I think generally dentists are not trained at all to open their own practice. we have no financial, as in, you know, when we're at university, no one teaches us about finances, about applying for loans or any of this, but also the nursing side of things. I have the most phenomenal head nurse, and if it wasn't for her, or maybe if she's listening, shout out, actually she's probably in the room next door, but if it wasn't for her and her knowledge and her help, this practice wouldn't have been what it is now. And that's because as a dentist, we learn, we are dentists, and we actually sometimes, I don't think, fully appreciate what our nurses do for us. Even, you know, I didn't know the difference between like autoclaves, about like a vacuum and a non-vac autoclave. I didn't know all of this. Like, I sounded so stupid when I was ordering some of this stuff. And I remember calling DD up and being like, do I need an ultrasonic bath? Like, what is it? And, you know, and it's like, now I laugh at it because I know everything about it. But I think that for anyone who's opening their dental practice, you either need to learn all of this yourself or you need to have an awesome nurse on your side.
And you're not taught that at dental school?
Not at all. I mean, we're taught, you know, disinfection or like, no, not really. Like, I would not have known how to work an autoclave and to, you know, clean my instruments in an ultrasonic. I would have absolutely no idea. Or how to clean the chair after a day has finished, you know, what liquids to use or when to clean it and how to take the filters out. Like, no, because dentists are known for, they stroll in 5 minutes before their first patient and then they leave 2 minutes before the patient's left. You know, like, that was me for the past 4 or 5 years. I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes.
And that's the thing, as an associate with a good nurse, you can operate like that. You're there to deliver clinical dentistry, and your nurse is doing all these things in the background. But as a practice owner, you need to understand it, because you need to order the equipment, the materials, you need to understand the process. You're going to be the person who's going to be preparing the documentation to make sure you get through your CQC process. So I get you need to understand.
How do you ever evolve and ever refine if you don't actually know what you're supposed to be doing?
I mean, on the finance side of things, we're starting to work with dental schools. We're starting to try and do some work to educate people on the basics of business finance. Because I think you're right. I think that's a massive gap. And, you know, If dentists just say as an associate, just understanding the tax they have to pay and what the numbers look like, it's really important, because I think if you understand the numbers, it makes you an incredibly valuable associate. If all you do is turn up and do your dentistry, don't get me wrong, from a patient care point of view, it's still outstanding, but you're not as valuable as a business person in a practice.
Do you remember we used to do some seminars about buying a dental practice? And I always remember we'd said to people, what normally happens is you come out of dental school, you do your FD, then you start earning money, and then you all go and buy a Porsche. And it was quite funny. We had a room of about 30 people, and about 12 people reached forward and took their keys off their desk and put them in their pocket, because they obviously all owned Porsches. It was like, there we go. I think that's the answer for that one.
They'd all done that. Victoria, I'm conscious of time, and I know you have clinic this afternoon. It's been a fascinating conversation, and honestly, I'm so pleased for you And I'm so excited to see what this looks like over the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years, and whether it becomes kind of the core to dentistry. Because it's a really, as a non-clinician, I find it a fascinating area.
You haven't done bad for a young one, area. Have you, really? I mean, in at first, like, flipping it. Yeah.
Yeah, very impressive. Flip. Very, very impressive. But we can't let you leave just yet, because we have to ask you two questions before you can go and treat your patients. And the first question we've got for you is, if you could be a fly on a wall in a situation, yeah, when would that be, and where would you be if you were given the opportunity?
And you can't use the CQC wondering what a infrared bath thing was.
I actually, you know what, I knew that this question was coming, and I was thinking about it for so long, and I still didn't come up with an answer, because it's like, this is impossible. fly on a wall in a situation. Okay. I'm taking it completely different. The Berlin Wall, when it was being broken down. Yeah, totally different, but I think that would have been pretty wild when East and West Germany were reunited. So that's a wall that I would want to be a fly on.
Yeah, that would be very cool, wouldn't it?
I did a tour of Berlin a couple of years ago, and the guy who took us on our walking tour, he takes you in front of is it Brandenburg Gate? Mm. And that's where one of the wall was. And he then shows a picture of himself on top of the Berlin Wall on the night that it was going to come down. And I was thinking, flip, can you imagine if you'd have been there at that moment in time? Oh, what would that have felt like? You know, and he then got a bit of wall out of his pocket. Wow. He said, you know, and then he broke the wall down.
It's like, properly history in the making. Yeah, history in the making.
Yeah.
And our follow-up question is, if you could meet somebody, if you were given the opportunity to meet somebody and sit down and have a cup of coffee or a glass of wine, who would you like to meet?
Alive or dead?
Either. Or fictional.
Someone I would like to have a coffee with would be, okay, right now, speaking of what we were talking about earlier, is Tim Spector. Yes. Really want to meet him. And if he's listening out, then please come to my clinic. But I just think that he has done a crazy thing for health, and he's making personalized medicine. Please do. Personalized medicine. I think he's making it accessible to everyone. Mm. And I think that the next step would be dentistry. I mean, I want to do something similar to that, or, you know, like that's the future. Wow. And I think that he's incredible as a result.
I think what's interesting is that in some ways there's some parallels with his work and your work, because he was behind the COVID app that everybody was filling in every day saying whether they felt well, and that's how that data built. And I think that was kind of the thing that sparked off Zoe. So in many ways, how things have gone in the direction for him and how things have gone with you, at some point it'd be quite nice if it did come together.
Yeah, visionary. Yeah. So I go back to visionary. Yeah. I think you're a bit of a visionary on what you want to achieve. It's amazing.
Victoria, thank you for your time. It's been wonderful. It's been a great conversation. And I think if we come back and have this same conversation in 2 or 3 years' time, it is going to look and sound completely different.
So it's going to be fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. We should probably book it in.
Exactly. But no, we really appreciate your time today. It's great. And look forward to seeing you. I think we're both going to the next Dental Collective in a month or so.
Yes.
So look forward to seeing you then.
Yeah, brilliant. Excellent. Thank you. Amazing. Thank you for your time. Right.
Look after yourself. Cheers, Victoria.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.